from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on December 1st when Governor Kathy Hochul signed a bill into law. That bill, the Child Poverty Reduction Act, commits New York State to reducing child poverty by 50% over the next 10 years. So that was easy. It's good that that got done. Look, this is complicated. There is not any guarantee that these kind of efforts work, but this is an ambitious plan. And Assemblymember Harry Bronson and Senator Jessica Ramos, who you heard last hour, are the bill's sponsors. We discussed it in June after the state legislature had passed it and was awaiting the governor's signature. And you can certainly say the stakes are high. More than 895,000 children in New York live in poverty. It's one out of five kids. The situation in Rochester is more dire, with half the children in this city living in poverty. Now that the act is law, what will it take to accomplish the goal? This hour, we continue the conversation with state lawmakers about legislation aimed at helping our kids. And I'd like to welcome Assemblymember Harry Bronson back to the program. Thank you. Thank you for making time to be here, sir.
Evan, thank you for having me.
And with us in studio, the executive director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, Aqua Porter, is back. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
On the phone with us, the CEO of the Children's Agenda, Larry Marks, is with us. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
And Candace Cabral is a mother of four who is with us. Hi, Candace. Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Aqua, your role as the head of our MAPI is reduction of poverty. And, you know, I mean, it's easy to say we passed this. It's going to get done. It's a hugely ambitious goal here. Does it strike you as a realistic one?
Absolutely. I think that in our country and specifically in our community, there's no reason that we can't significantly reduce poverty rates. And we know that a lot of the poverty in our community is child poverty. So I think that not only is it doable, but we don't morally, we have an obligation to make sure that we give our kids the best opportunity to have really strong, fulfilling lives. So,
and let me just ask you a little bit about where we are right now, because in 2021 in Rochester, half the kids are still living in poverty based on this, the standards of poverty set by certain metrics. I mean, that is a tragedy.
It's devastating.
I mean, it's devastating. And about 7 years ago on this program, we talked about the launch of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Ed Doherty, among others, warned us. He said, don't ask me what it's going to take to flip everything in a year, because this is probably a 15 to 30 year effort that we're talking about here. I took the point not to say that there shouldn't be accountability or that there shouldn't be benchmarks, but when we're talking about something that's been entrenched and often intentionally entrenched, if we're being serious about the structural issues, it's going to take time. That being said, now we're 7 years in. We haven't seen much of a movement at all with kids in poverty. We should all be deeply saddened by that. But why? Why are we 7 years in and we haven't seen movement?
Well, because one, the issue is complex, right? It's not, there's no silver bullet to solving poverty. It is a, and it's entrenched in our structures, in our institutions, in our beliefs and our practices. And so in order to untangle those things takes a lot of people with courage and bold ideas and the will to actually dismantle the systems that have built it. So if we focus on the idea that people believe that people have this, that it's a person's issue, poverty is not about someone who is not working hard enough to get out of poverty. There are things that are continuously reinforcing that poverty is the place where people should be and that we need a class of poor people. And so we have to kind of untangle all of those systems, those beliefs, those practices. Those things take time and they take intention and they take a will.
Just to make sure I understand, I think what you're saying is there is a section, kind of a part of the ethos that some people have about this country that says poverty is just an outgrowth of a capitalistic society. It's okay. Some people will be poor. Some people will be middle class. Some people will have a lot. You can't control that. And that's just life. Is that what you're saying?
I think that there is that belief. And I think that our economics kind of rely on this lower class of people that we have to overcome that. I mean, there are countries outside of the United States that don't have that belief, that innate belief. They believe that people should, you know, not necessarily be poor and that we need to do what we can as a nation to make sure that we work to eradicate the conditions that cause poverty.
We're going to talk to Candace about her story in a moment, and I know Larry has a lot to share about how the Children's Agenda sees the current scenario for kids in the city and in this region. I mean, it shouldn't be acceptable to anybody. But, Assemblymember, let's talk about specifically what this actually means. What just got passed and what's going to happen here?
Sure. There's some magic in this bill, if you will. And the magic is the idea to make a commitment as a state, we are going to do this. And we're the first in the nation to use this approach. It's been used in Europe and successfully so. In that commitment, we start with, this is the goal. Then we have an advisory council that has the essential stakeholders in it, including a number of state agencies, which will force them to talk to each other about the issue. That council will set forth policy recommendations to be considered by the legislature and by the executive branch, and from there set benchmarks so that we can hold ourselves accountable. And accountable in two ways. Are we reaching the goals that we said we were going to reach on this time frame? And if we're not, what adjustments do we have to make? What's not working? The other piece of it that is unique here is to have on that advisory council experts from the community that know this issue. And so you have government working with the private nonprofit sector to come up with policies with benchmarks to hold us accountable. That has not been tried statutorily. And I think with the urgency that we have right now with poverty, the fact that our society is reckoning ourselves with racial injustice is a unique time that we need to take advantage of. And also the movement, and Aqua mentioned this briefly, the movement that's recognizing that our economy is really built on a systemic approach to create have and have nots. And this bill is going to force us to deal with those questions on how we can make changes in systemic racism and changes in our economy structure in such a way that makes it a more equitable economy.
Is it oversimplifying to say that this is a way to try to create a society in which there are not have and have nots, but just have and have mores?
I like that. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that before, Evan, but I think that is a nice way to phrase it. That, you know, sure, you know, I you've asked me on your show before, do I believe in capitalism? I do. But I do believe that capitalism needs to be checked in some regards, but it also should have the goal that we all can be successful. The beauty, this bill is we as a state saying we want our children to move from poverty to a place of opportunity and allow them to seize upon the opportunities that they choose that fit with their goals and their dreams and their aspirations, and in so doing, to allow them to be successful from an economic standpoint.
Larry Marks, how do you see this one?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I think there's some reason for optimism, that poverty is not some blunt inevitability. It's not like the weather, some immutable fact of nature. It's human-made. It can be dismantled by humans, too. And in fact, with federal action recently, with the child tax credit, that's happening. The poverty rate in our country, according to Columbia University Center on Poverty and Social Policy, is dropping as a result of that tax credit expansion and other federal policy changes. So just in the last month, the fourth monthly payment of the expanded child tax credit kept 3.6 million children from poverty in October, just a month and a half ago. So there are ways to reduce poverty. It's not rocket science. We know what can be done. And again, this isn't something just to complain about, like it's getting cold outside. This is something that we can actually do.
Candace, as a mother of four, tell me about how life is in 2021 for your family.
It's been challenging, I can say that. Either having teenagers and having younger kids and trying to get them just in the community or even yourself, economic-wise, guys, it's been really hard. I can honestly say lately, like he just said, it's little by little, just having little checks, credit, just having little organizations opening and welcome you back inside and to be able to help you and your kids or even school to be open. I say, guys, that's a start. Even if we have so much stuff going on in the schools, because the kids been out for a while. So to me, our comedy is going to take a long time. But I do see Rochester is heading in the right direction because a lot of us want to start together and be together. And before we have it, organizations work with each other and that's what you're about. But now I see organizations are saying we need to be together. I see we can honestly help each other and other organizations. And that's what's been happening for me. If I need help with driving or if I need help with education, they're trying to put it in the same building. So even if it could be in my kid's school, that would help a parent because you're in the school, you're still checking on your child, and you're also getting the things you need while you're in this building. So I do see it coming soon, guys.
Candace, I know you've talked about, and if you could, I'd love for you to tell our listeners a little bit about the impact that was made on your life, especially in 2017. You know, you have your you're having your fourth child, you're dealing with depression, you had lost a friend. You had a couple of losses in your life, and you participated in pregnancy education classes at Healthy Moms, and there are some things that started to happen in the way you were thinking about yourself and your life. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, my God, yes. That was – in that time, I can say for anybody right now, due to COVID, everybody's going through the same situation that you just told that amazing story. What I can say for me – I was still depressed when I was going through these cycles, guys. You got to think in these classrooms. I didn't know what I was having the whole time. I was pregnant. I kind of wanted it to be a surprise because I have three boys previously. So mental health was the biggest thing for me. I really had to take time for myself and really know myself, really deep in like my struggles of my insecurities of not reading, just where I was in life. I had to really step out in my own self before I say, oh, organization can be able to help me. That was the first step. But when I was there, I started seeing other women and other people were going through the similar things, but they were still like fighting. Like no matter what, women and people in poverty, we always fight. And we always try to find the things that's in the community that's best fit for our kids. So that was the start for me, guys. But then I met this lady named Mary Ann Davis, and her story just was amazing. She was, you know, she came from the war. She just had this amazing story about her kids and adopting kids. Just changing our life and just always being there just to have a conversation. So for me, it's just knowing that you have somebody that I didn't have family here. I needed to find family, and the community was my family and still is my family. Different churches, different people, but that was the start of going to Salvation Army or going to other places and seeing people and seeing myself where we were and where we were trying to get to.
You know, I've been reading that you've want to go back and pursue a diploma, a high school diploma. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Did you, you know, maybe earlier in your life think, you know, that doesn't matter. That's not who I am. Can you tell me a little bit about the way your feelings on your own education have maybe evolved?
Yeah, I can tell you. Let me give you two stories. The first one is that I was a 16-year-old girl just coming back into Rochester from Auburn, New York, just coming from a group home. And my mom was leaving out of Rochester to go to Florida. I wanted to go to Wilson Foundation on Genesee. I was going there, but I became homeless at the age of 17. I wanted to go to school so bad, but I was so worried about everybody talking about what I was wearing and what was going on. So I still, through all these years, guys, I still wanted to go to school, and I always found organizations. If it was a tutor or BOCES, anything that had, I was still had that in my heart and wanted to. But then I have kids too, so it was just dealing with kids and trying to move in the system. It was like really hard. But when you finally find a program, like you said, Healthy Moms, or a program that can give you all in one, I felt very comfortable. It was women that either had a high school diploma and you were going for business, women were going for classes. Me, I have a learning disability. So my grade point average, guys, for reading was at a 2.3. now becoming now. It was that at that time. Now I'm at a 5.3. So that's still better than where I was back then. And that's through all these videos, having conversation, learning by hand. Everybody learns different. So like you said, how I thought I was learning back then is totally different how I'm learning now.
What do you think people who are listening and haven't experienced poverty don't understand about poverty, Candace?
Like you said, poverty, you don't wake up with it. It's generational. It's intentional. It's government. I don't want to get too politics, guys. It's really, it's not in your household. You know, it.
Candace, the floor is yours. You can do whatever you want.
But guys, you know what I mean? Like literally, if your mother come from welfare, you ever had assistance from using a government, automatically, that's a poverty sign, automatically. Even if you had a job and you were working from nursing and you don't need as much, but you need Medicaid, or so they still put you in a category of being poverty. So to me, it's not just a color of skin, or if it's not politics, guys, it's all in one bundle. Where we come from, where you zip code, where you live, everything is involved. How you raise and where you come up in being poverty, in my mind.
Yeah, I ask about what people don't understand or the assumptions we make because we still, I think, fall into certain mindsets about our world, the way it's structured, people who are living in poverty. I think about a phone call we got yesterday, and I'm not trying to be unkind or ungenerous, but I think we got to be direct about this. So a listener called, we were talking about vaccination. And a listener said, vaccination rates in the city of Rochester in certain census tracts are below 50%. They're high poverty. And the listener was saying, hey, how about if people are getting welfare, then they have to get vaccinated. If they're living on the government, then they have to get vaccinated. And I was so tempted. Well, I think I mentioned, I said, so does that mean Goldman Sachs has to be all vaccinated? Does that mean that any company that on Wall Street that broke the financial world and we had to bail out with our tax dollars, do they all have to be vaccinated? Or is it just poor people who are mostly people of color who live in the city? Because I think we have this idea that, well, that's who gets help from the government. We have a society in which, look at the top 10 earning companies in New York State. We mentioned it last hour. JPMorgan Chase, Verizon, Citigroup, IBM, MetLife, Pepsi, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. Did anybody think that they don't get government money in many different ways? Is this a pure capitalism where it's just survival of the fittest? It is not. We've made choices on who gets money, and then we convince ourselves, well, only certain people aren't getting by and they're living on the government. That's baloney. And we got to be very careful about that mindset that says, well, this census tract is more the problem, or this city is the problem, or these families are the problem. I'm not saying personal responsibility doesn't come into it, but boy, we tell ourselves some myths here. And I'm just going to get off that phone call.
Evan.
I'm trying.
Just saying. Preach,
okay.
Evan.
Well, I'm trying to be kind.
Evan, I'm so proud of you. I love when they literally, I'm glad you're putting this in my mouth. Literally, let me say, I literally volunteer at Edgerton for vaccination. They're putting these vaccination clinics around a neighborhood, like you said, that we're all connected to it. And majority, I would love, Evan, for you to get that number from me, because literally, I feel the community is getting vaccinated so many ways. If you're homeless, if you're not, you're a veteran. Literally, I feel between me going to Edgerton every Sunday from the morning to like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we get over 50 to almost 300 people, guys, around just in these centers that mm-hmm. come there. And majority of these people, I say 50% or even maybe 70%. Live in our community. Mm-hmm. So it can be out. I say maybe 10% is from Greece, Pittsburgh, wherever else outside of interstate Rochester. But to me, they are getting vaccinated, and I'm proud of them, because a lot of us, even myself, was not comfortable, all the policies, all the talk. But for a person come from poverty, and we're constantly even putting things in our body from medicine, or like you said, mental health, or you're putting different things in your body that you don't need to. It's literally a certain way that in my mind, it's all programmed the same way. But to me, like you said, that is a big number. And that's 95 people in poverty are getting vaccinated in households. They are vaccinated. So I'm proud of that. And we went from 50% to 75% in my mind.
Yeah. Candace, you're a remarkable person. I'm glad you're with us this hour as we talk about this effort, this ambitious effort over the next decade to cut child poverty across New York State. in half, and we're talking about it from a number of different angles so we can understand it better. Aqua, you said preach. I don't like to preach. I just, that call that call kind of got under my skin because I think people, I don't think the caller was trying to, I don't think that caller was thinking nefarious thoughts. I think we just tell ourselves stories about the world. Sometimes we tell ourselves a story that, well, I'm purely self-sufficient. I've never needed help, or I've never needed, we've all benefited in different ways.
It's a narrative that's out there, though, right? Like, there are only certain people, like a public benefit is somehow different from a tax incentive that a business gets.
A star credit. Yeah, all
exactly.
kinds of, right?
Exactly. It's just, it's the narrative and how we, you know, frame them. The language has a difference, and it gets under people, into people's heads. And so, yeah, people don't believe that we bailed out the auto industry after, right, in, what, 2008?
In like, 2008, yep.
Where'd that money come from? It's the same money that we're talking about potentially providing to families. It's all the same source of revenue. It's just how do we allocate it? And I think that there could be some different ways to allocate it toward citizens in our country.
Well, and if, Larry, I was going to turn to you here, and I want to give you the floor, but I also want to mention that if people are sort of skeptical about how this can happen, you have pointed out that England, for example, saw a marked shift starting in the 90s based on different programs. There are analogs out there that we can point to, Larry.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you guys are pointing out, we give away money to a lot of different places for a lot of different things. I don't know how Goldman Sachs necessarily uses their tax breaks, but there is data from the U.S. Census now on the uses of poor people in the state of New York between July and August of this year, how they used the first two child tax credit payments. 48% went to food. So 48% was spent on food, 37% on essential bills, 33% on clothing, 32% on rent and mortgage. Food insecurity has dropped. Severe food insecurity in the state of New York has gone down from 20.6% to 8%, according to the U.S. Census. So that, to me, is one of the highest, best uses we could ever see of public money. It's not that people are blowing this at the track. Again, I don't know how Goldman Sachs uses their tax breaks or developers use theirs. But when you're talking about poor people getting public funding, they do what's right by their families and by their kids, and they take care of very basic needs. So clothing and rent and food, that strikes me particularly for children who have no choice in the matter. That strikes me as an incredibly good use of public funding.
Yeah, and I mean, Larry, just last year, you know who else got public funding? Got payroll protection? The L.A. Lakers and Shake Shack. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, like, I love LeBron James. I'm from Cleveland, but I don't think he and the Lakers needed payroll protection. I think they can pay him his contract. And it's just an example that we paint these pictures in our mind of who gets government money. Well, pretty much all of us. But sometimes in absurd amounts when they don't need it. And then Larry paints a picture of what families who are, you know, on the edge are using it for. And it, all of a sudden, it's a very, very different picture. But Larry, that context, that historical context, I think there are cynics or skeptics about what can work here. What does history tell you about what's possible?
Yeah, well, you mentioned England, and in the 90s, England did drop its child poverty rate in half, and it did it through a combination of, what do you know, tax credits, extending child care and pre-kindergarten programs so that families could work. The workforce participation of women during that period in England shot up dramatically. The United States is, of the industrialized world, one of the lowest workforce participation rates of any, and that's largely because of the lack of affordable, quality child care options. We've seen that now just in an acute way during the pandemic of women dropping out of the workforce because primarily they are our social safety net when it comes to children. England cut child poverty by using child care tax credits, working tax credits, and actually expanding home visiting programs for new moms and their infants. So things like that can have been proven to work before. They can work again and are working again.
And Assemblymember Harry Bronson, remind listeners what the actual mechanisms are, what's going to happen here. And I know personally for you, you've talked about it here, but this is a good moment to remind people that you have also been in a number of different places and circumstances in your own life.
Sure. Thanks for bringing that up. You know, when I was very young, I lived in a household that didn't have running water or indoor plumbing. We heated the home with wood-burning stove. My mom and dad, getting to the idea of working poor, my mom and dad both worked full-time jobs. They worked overtime whenever they could work overtime. And they ran the family farm to provide for the family. And it's from that context that I have come to recognize the need for us to address poverty and address the things of making sure that workers are getting good minimum wage at the very least, but livable wages, making sure that families have access to health care, making sure that families are assisted when needed, just as was pointed out, we assist government. Or assist corporations. So what's really great about this, and I just pulled out my notes, I mean, it forces membership in an advisory council, which I mentioned will set forth policy recommendations and funding recommendations, by the way, but from the Office of Children and Family Services, the Department of Taxation and Finance, the Regional Economic Development Councils, and then nonprofit groups from across the state will be included too. Why is that important? It's important so that when we are facing next year's budget, we have an advisory council that's going to say, well, yeah, we're giving tax credits here to the employers for XY benefit. What are the tax credits that we can do that will directly go to families that will help us reduce poverty? When we're talking about what programs do we fund, can we, and workforce development is mentioned in the statute as well. What for workforce development, and I'll put a plug, we're doing a public hearing on the economy and workforce development and how we can use that as a tool to make our economy more equitable and more inclusive. So this advisory council can look at those issues as well and make policy recommendations to remove the systemic barriers that so many people in our communities have faced for decades and have held them down. So the mechanism is put in place, and we've done a good job of getting the voices of stakeholders that will be necessary that we look at this in a comprehensive way. And then we have to hold ourselves accountable. We have to constantly evaluate, are we moving forward? And if we're not, we have to make adjustments. But, you know, the narrative that you and Aqua and Candace were talking about, and what Candace shared about, you know, some of her experiences, you know, living in poverty, it moves young people oftentimes to a place where they don't see possibilities. They feel hopelessness and they feel helplessness. And when you're in that condition, it's very hard to make good decisions and long-term decisions because it's all about the moment. And unfortunately, we have too many families that are there. You know, how do I put food on the table? Do I go to this food bank so that I can get extra food? How do I balance childcare with trying to take on those extra hours so that I can get overtime pay? We're hopeful that with this structure in place, those kind of issues will be discussed and approaches to resolve those issues, removing the barriers that hold people in poverty, that we're going to take steps to change that.
Well, let me get a little bit of listener feedback, both phone and email. A little bit of feedback, a little bit of pushback. We'll see what listeners are saying here. Michael in Fairport first. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Evan. How you doing?
Good, sir.
My comment is that politicians can't pass legislation to solve poverty. Giving people money only solves an immediate and urgent need, which there is a need, but it doesn't do anything to solve poverty. And I think that the only way to solve poverty is to get kids to graduate from high school, either go to college or get into vocational training so they can get jobs that pay enough so they can live a life that's not in poverty. And when I hear politicians talk about solving poverty, and it's been done for years and years and years, and being accountable and all this, it's just talk to make them sound good. In Rochester, I'm a big fan of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Rochester because they do exactly what I just said. You know, they get these kids at a young age. They keep them out of gangs. They teach them things. They have a literacy program. They get them to graduate from high school. They get them into college or some kind of program. But giving people money doesn't solve poverty. It there's a need where people have problems and need money, but it doesn't solve poverty. And the only way to solve poverty is you have to look at the long term. It can't be done overnight. It can't be done in 5 years. It takes a generation. But you got to start with the kids. And what this person that was just on your show there was just talking about, where they don't have hope, that's very, very true. But you got to start with the kids, and you've got to do something so they can live a life where they can earn enough money so they're not in poverty.
Michael, can you hang on there for one? Can you hang there for 1 second, Mike? Because I appreciate the phone call, and I want to give all of our guests a chance to kind of weigh in on that. Let me start with Aqua Porter, who's the executive director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative.
So I would say, Michael, that I think that we can hold both of the things that you're talking about together. Money gives people space. It provides them with a way to cover their basic needs. So if you gave families money where they are below the ability to cover their basic needs with their income, it provides them with the space and the opportunities so that they can either do things like make sure there's food on their table for their families. Maybe they don't have to work two jobs, so they can kind of focus in on making one job work that pays them enough so that they can provide childcare for their children. Money starts to help provide space for families who need to be able to cover their basic needs. So I think that money does help. I also think that there are programs and policies that our government officials can help to change. Like, what our government officials can do is help to change policies. And those policies and those structures are the things that reinforce poverty or reinforce who can have access to dollars or funding or programs. Like, there is a big need in our country to look at the policies that shape the way our families live. And that is exactly what our politicians can help to change. So I think that I don't agree with you that our elected officials can't make a difference. I think the legislation that addresses structures and behaviors or practices or how dollars are funded are absolutely what we hold them accountable to do.
Let me ask Larry Marks if you want to weigh in on that too. Go ahead.
Yeah, just it, as Aqua said, it is a both and not an either or, that the number one determinant of whether a child graduates from high school is the family income. That is the number one correlation that over 40, 50 years has been proven beyond anything. So there is a determination of a family's income for a child's success. And that's true for their health. It's true for their education. It's true for their lifelong success. It's also true that having high school graduation or being part of an excellent program like the Boys and Girls Club or others will also improve a child's chances for health and education and long-term success. But it's not an either-or.
Candace, what do you think? What do you make of the phone call we had there?
Thanks, Michael, for calling in. I agree with Michael and everybody on the panel, guys. The only thing I wanted to point out that Michael kept mentioning, guys, is that we need to put more, when the kid's getting ready to graduate or getting prepared to graduate, we do need them to understand what's the next level that they're going to. Is it going to be college? Is it you getting a business? Making sure we have that lined up, guys, so we are making sure our kids are having 100% chance of graduation. But I do agree with both. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, Assemblymember Runson, I think Michael is saying he's heard this before. He's heard politicians for years say, we can fix this, and then a program rolls out, and X amount of money gets spent, and we don't move the needle.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And, you know, I heard a motivational speaker say once, your toddler stands up, tries to walk, and falls down. You pick him up, he tries to walk, he falls down again. How many times do you let him fall down before you say, stop trying to walk? It's the same thing here. Has there been failure in this area? Absolutely. Absolutely. But that doesn't mean that government isn't part of the solution. We have to be part of the solution. You know, we have a $200 billion state budget. Politicians get to decide how that $200 billion is spent. I'm with Michael. Some of that money should go to the Boys and Girls Club. Some of that money should go to other organizations that do the work in on the ground to help move people out of poverty. I can't go into the homes of that 895,000 New York children living in poverty and solve their poverty problem. I can't do that. What I can do is to make policy decisions and funding decisions that removes barriers to success, that creates opportunities for success, and recognizes that a long history of racial disparities and a long history of promoting capitalism at the expense of hardworking men and women, I can address those issues at the very broad level. And why we have so many stakeholders and community organizations involved in this advisory group, and also people who have come from living in poverty. We will have two people appointed there as well. They can help us with developing the comprehensive policy shifts that we have to have to remove those barriers and move young people from living in poverty to having opportunities.
Let me ask Michael if he wants to follow up before we let him go. Go ahead, Michael.
Thank you. I don't think advisory groups are going to solve poverty. I think that government and money, yes, there's people in poverty that need immediate help, and I'm not against that. What I'm talking about is solving the poverty problem. And I think that they're two different issues, and I don't think that for 30 years I've heard and listened and been to meetings about solving poverty, and it hasn't happened. They haven't made any progress on it. And I think that if the government has money that they can spend towards trying to solve poverty, it should go into programs that work with kids so they can grow up and have an income so they're not in poverty. That's the only way to solve it. Other than just paying them money every year forever, which obviously is not feasible.
But are you saying that it's a cultural issue?
Well, I think that people in poverty face obstacles, and as has been said by your guests, and lower income families, you know, they have a lesser chance of success. But I still think that the key is to get to these kids when they're young, when they're in school, and make sure they go through programs so that they can grow up and be successful. You can't change it overnight. You can't just have a policy and an advisory group. And you said there's going to be two people in poverty. I went to a meeting, I might have called about this before. It was like 30 years ago, and I don't remember too much about it, but it was it was put on by Gannett. Dave Mack at the time was the publisher. He chaired the meeting. I know there were media people there. I don't remember who else. But what I do remember is at the end of the meeting, they had some kids there. I don't remember if they were from MCC or from high school. But one kid got up and he said, I never forget this to this day. He says, you know, it's really nice that you people come together to talk about solving poverty. He goes, but at the end of the day, you all go home to your nice homes in the suburbs. He goes, I go back to poverty.
But that's why you do need advisory councils, right? That's why you need the Candace Cabrals, right? That's why you need the multiple perspectives, don't you?
Yeah.
No, because you need action. And I don't think advisory councils result in action. It's just a way for the people involved to look good and to feel good that maybe they're doing something. I think that you got to start with the kids and the programs and forget the advisory council. If they know how to do it, you know, Dwayne Mahoney at the Boys and Girls Clubs, they know how to do it. Now, they have maybe 400 kids, or give or take a few. But if there were programs like that where you could get the majority of kids in that age group that they serve into them.
Scale it up.
You know, 20 years, poverty would be dramatically reduced in Rochester. If you do that, dramatically. But it's going to take 20 years. It takes a generation. Yeah. And I just think there's too much talk about policy and procedures and concepts and theories and not enough action, because it's not rocket science.
Let me jump in here, Michael, and just say, first of all, I'm grateful that you called. Thank you for that. And I'm sure Assembly Member Bronson and others, they want tough questions and pushback. I would suggest that if you are saying that the people who've claimed they could solve it for decades don't usually come from poverty and don't succeed, that's why the advisory councils are existing, and they are much more diverse than they used to be. And I'm not just talking about race. I'm talking about socioeconomics. Aqua Porter, can you speak a little bit to that? Because I understand Michael's point.
I do, too. I do, too. But I think that, you know, we are looking for solving this problem at the root cause, right? So it means looking at structures and systems and policies and those things to dismantle those. The people who can do that are, one, the people who understand what those systems are because they live in them every day. They can help inform us of this doesn't work. Like, right? This works. Because I will agree with you, Michael, that there are people who are sitting in the ivory towers who probably don't have a street level view like Candace does of what's going on in her life and her household that can help to inform those who are making policy decisions or allocating funding on what things work. We need those two things to come together. We need both of them. Like, this is one of those and plus, right? It's not one or the other. It's both and. We need people who can help us understand, who provide us with that lived experience, who can help give us real insight as to what works and what doesn't. And then we need the people with the power who can change policies and direct funding to those places. I think they have to come together.
Can I also ask CEO of the Children's Agenda, Larry Marks, on this? I mean, we've talked to your colleague, Pete Nabosny, on this program about the question of how to help people more directly and more efficiently. Because what we definitely know is it's been lots of programs over the years. A lot of people who would benefit don't know they exist, can't get there, don't have transportation, all kinds of issues. And so one of the things that Pete has mentioned on this program is kind of, at least as far as I understand, and maybe you can elaborate, it goes a little bit against what Michael's saying. Michael's, I think, if I'm quoting him correctly, he's saying just giving somebody money isn't going to solve the problem. But Pete has said, actually, there's something elegant and efficient about that. And generally, the studies do indicate that that is a more effective way, just being more direct with people and saying, okay, instead of this program and this qualification and fill out this application and then renew it on X month, just give people money. And guess what? It works a lot better. That's the argument Pete has made, and that's based on evidence, as I understand it, Larry. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. There is a capitalistic efficiency to supplementing household income. So just to be clear, the child tax credit provides families with $3,600 for every child in a household under the age of 6 and $3,000 for every child between the ages of 6 and 17. That money in itself is not a substitute for a livable wage at all. It doesn't come close to lifting people out of poverty. But when you look at how it's being spent, it's supplementing, it's reduced food insecurity, hungry kids can't learn. It's going to pay essential bills, things like clothing and rent and mortgage. kids who are shuffled from house to house to house or situation to situation can't learn and can't even stay in programs. So that $3,600 is one of the best investments that you can imagine. And what's beautiful about it is that families decide how to spend it based on what the – maybe it is a family that says, we need a car to get to work, mm-hmm. or I need to put some food on the table now. We're okay with our transportation. We're okay with our house. Or maybe it's another family that's behind on rent and can secure – where they're living and the school that they're in for the next several years thanks to that child tax credit. So, again, it's not enough to lift families or children by itself out of poverty, but it's a great example of if you trust people who are living in poverty and give them the means, they'll be able to solve their own problems.
Candace, what do you most need right now?
A wish list. literally, I can't even imagine, guys. I would love the high school diploma. Like I said, I have teenagers. I would love just for them to get their high school diploma. Like you said, break that generational curse. So I don't really have anything besides the community. I just want that lightning just up, guys.
Michael, I appreciate that call very much, and I'm glad you did call. And let me just read an email from a listener who says, when I think of our economic system, I think of a pyramid where there will always be a greater number of people on the lower income side, though not necessarily or justifiably in poverty. But if you were going to invert that, it doesn't seem like it's logical. He says, for the simple fact that there will always be more lower skill, lower paying positions. It is simply not practical nor probable for everyone or even a greater majority of citizens to be in the higher percentile standard distribution of income. You can and should reduce poverty. But the fallacy, I think, is that people believe we can actually eliminate it entirely. Can you give an example of capitalism where this pyramid is inverted or non-existent? Assemblymember Bronson?
Well, I disagree with the premise. That's not the purpose of this bill. It's not the purpose of our commitment as a state to reduce child poverty by 50%. Right there tells you we're not saying we're going to reduce or have no poverty, nor are we saying that we want more people at the lower pay scale instead of the small number of people who are ultra wealthy. What we are saying is to be intentional about our commitment and make adjustments to policy and make adjustments to funding so that we're recognizing what Aqua pointed out earlier, that a little assistance today will help a family to get a little bit of respite so they're not in crisis mode every single minute of every single day. That's what that small tax credit, that's what giving them a little bit of extra money directly. So that's part of the equation to success. But we also have to do other things. Look, I mentioned earlier, I have to make a lot of decisions when it comes to budget. I'd like to be intentional about my decisions on which tax credits I'm going to be supporting, my decisions about what agency needs additional funding, my decisions about what community-based organizations need, my decisions on what the reimbursement rates are going to be for childcare, reimbursement rates in other areas that we have control over as state legislators. I want to be intentional and ask the question that's going to be set up by this advisory group. Will that decision move us in the direction of reducing child poverty? That's what this is all about. And so it's not about, getting rid of the capitalist system. It's not about inverting that pyramid.
Or getting rid of rich people.
Or getting rid of rich people. They can pay
rich people.
They can pay, more of their share. This really is, and I got to thank Larry and the Children's Agenda and the Schuyler Center. They brought this bill to me, and I looked at it and said, wow, this fits my objective as a policymaker, and I really believe we can do this. And, a 10-year goal, I think really helps us to stay on task to reduce poverty.
Aqua, final thoughts from you, about 30 seconds. What do you want to leave with listeners?
I want to tell people that I'm just reading this quote that I love, which is that the toxic stress of early poverty stunts children's development, creating opportunity gaps that can last a lifetime and harm the nation's economy. Poor children are more likely to have poor academic achievement, drop out of high school, and later become unemployed, experience economic hardships, and be involved in the criminal justice system. Children who experience poverty are also more likely to be poor at 30 than children who never experience poverty. To me, that encapsulates why we have to work on child poverty, because if we want to have any shot of eradicating poverty, start with the children. Let's make sure that we don't have children that are born and experience poverty. It exacerbates, just like Candace told us.
And Larry Marks, keep it tight. Final words from you.
Go team. We've started a 10-year journey, and I think it's within our grasp. We can make this happen.
Candace Cabral, I'm grateful for your time. You really are clearly a remarkable person, and thank you for sharing the perspective and for being real and honest with us and keeping us real and honest. We absolutely must do it that way. Thank you, Candace.
Thank you so much, guys, for having me. This was such a challenge, guys, for being here and even just having kids in the community. I can honestly just listen, for having mothers just out there and advocating for our life. So thank you so much, guys. Have a great one.
You got it. Much love to you, Candace. Thank you. Thank you, Larry Marks, for CEO of the Children's Agenda. Thanks. Aqua Porter, Executive Director of RMAPI, thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Assembly Member Harry Brunson, I think callers like Michael and others are going to hold you accountable, and they should on this, and I know you welcome that.
I look forward to it. Thank you, Evan.
Thanks for being here. From the whole team here, Megan Mack doing double duty, producing and engineering, and Emma Ray Stein, Evan Dawson saying thanks for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.